we've been reading for a while about the potential risk of COVID-19 to rural communities. I'd like to talk about how that's now manifesting. Do you anticipate the rural infection rate rising to the level of urban areas? And what are you now seeing that alarms you or that maybe gives you reason for hope?
What we're seeing now across the nation, as there's more and more data available and as the virus spreads, is that rural communities are seeing some of the biggest growth in cases. There's data that's showing that rural middle American states, the rate of increase is about twice that of the national average. And so that is concerning. I worry that the call to reopen the economy, people's fatigue with staying home, people's need to earn an income, is potentially out of sync with the risk that is still there in so many places.
Statistically speaking, rural communities are older. They have more healthcare issues. They have lower income. In the context of COVID-19, of these demographic factors, what concerns you the most about the health of rural communities?
The good news about coronavirus and COVID is that the vast majority of people who get this infection will do well. And we have to keep that in mind. But older people, people with underlying medical conditions, are at increased risk of having severe disease and dying from this. And so in communities where the population is older, that's a problem. In communities that economically are on the edge, it's a problem because people are being forced to make really hard decisions, decisions about going to work and having money to put food on the table and pay rent, or staying home and keeping away from others so they can help protect themselves and their families and their communities. And if it's a community where incomes are lower and there's less savings, there's not much of a choice there. People are going to be out and about more, and that increases their risk. In so many parts of rural America, we're seeing hospitals and other healthcare facilities close. And that's a challenge, because what you want is that if someone is developing symptoms, that they have the opportunity to be tested to know if they have COVID, that they're provided with support so that they can isolate away from family members and others. And we know in rural America, very many people live in households with multi-generations. And so while someone who is sick may not be in a high-risk group, there could be several people at home who are. And there may not be the space to be able to isolate away from other people. These things all put people at increased risk of not just having COVID infection, but of having more severe infection and spreading it to others.
You talked about stress, and even in communities with a low infection rate, there's a lot of stress over the threat of catching the virus, over finances, stress over just the unknown. Can you talk about the repercussions of that stress on both behavioral and physical health?
We know that, you know, in the short term, we deal with stress well physically. That feeling of stress gets us to change our behavior, that fight or flight feeling of stress, you run from danger. But when that stress occurs over time, day in, day out, over extended periods, it's not good for our bodies. Those stress hormones become very dangerous. And what we see is that people who are exposed to chronic stress, it sets them up for other health issues, inflammatory issues, whether it's heart disease or lung disease, or increases their risk of infectious diseases. So chronic stress is not a good thing. The stress of worrying about where finances are coming from, the stress from losing jobs, the stress of all of a sudden having your kids at home, and not only having to be a mom and a breadwinner, but also a teacher and a principal. There's a lot of stress there on everybody. And so thinking about how to use public health science to get people back to work in as safe a way as possible, that's critically important.
In an op-ed piece, you wrote, quote, "Those who have been historically marginalized in our country must not be marginalized again in our rush to reopen," unquote. A large percentage of rural residents are blue-collar workers. A large percentage work in the service industry. As we reopen our communities, these people are being told to go back to work. And I've heard some among those workers say that while they're being referred to as essential, they feel that they're being considered expendable. What are your thoughts on that, and on how much risk is acceptable as we reopen?
Yeah, I mean, that last question of how much risk is acceptable is a really important one. And the second part of that is, and who has to accept that risk? You know, that idea of who's essential and who's expendable is so important to talk about. We know that people of color, lower income people, have been in that category of more likely to be in the category of essential worker, have been more likely to get COVID, have been more likely to be hospitalized and more likely to die. As the economy opens up and people are being told to go back to work, we can't continue down this path of saying that lower income workers, essential workers, are also expendable workers. We need to make sure that everyone who's going back to work is doing so based on the best principles. So cases have to be going down. There has to be room in hospitals and healthcare facilities, not just for people with COVID, but for people to be seen for all of their medical issues. We need to make sure that for every industry that's coming back online, there are agreed upon standards for how to protect workers and that they're enforceable. Because there's such a power differential when someone in the service economy is told to come back to work and they get there and they're told, well, it doesn't look good for you to wear a mask. Well, what can they do? The option is not go to work and not get paid, or not wear a mask and increase your risk. So we want to make sure that workers are protected as they're coming back online, and they're not coming back online, not coming back to jobs until the conditions in their particular communities are such that it's safe to do so.
But you said that as we reopen, we must embrace the fight. And I think that's what you're describing there. What all does that entail, embracing that fight?
From a public health standpoint, it means demanding that there's data so that you can see problems as they arise. And so that's making sure that you're able to see who's getting infected and who's getting hospitalized and who's dying based on race and ethnicity, geography, income level. So you can see if particular communities are getting hit hard and look to address that. You want to make sure that testing is available widely and that you're looking at the testing rates broken down in the same way. So you can identify are there particular areas where there isn't enough testing or where the testing is showing that there's ongoing transmission. And I think one of the hardest things, but most important things, is that when someone is infected or they've been exposed, you need to work with people in communities to identify safe places for them to spend that 14-day period where they could be spreading this to somebody else or they could be brewing infection. If you're not doing that, if you're just telling someone you're infected and go home and isolate, and you're not recognizing that for so many people across this country, that's not possible to do without exposing other people. You're just identifying where those little clusters and outbreaks are going to be happening. You're not really preventing them. You know, and these are some of the short-term things. I mean, long-term, there's a lot we have to do to change the safety net in America. I mean, we're the wealthiest nation in the world, and we don't guarantee paid sick leave and family leave for everybody. You know, it's less than half of the lowest wage earners have sick leave or family leave. We don't ensure that everyone has unemployment insurance. We have more than 28 million people who don't have health insurance. And now with so many people losing their jobs, that number is gonna be skyrocketing. So there's so much that we need to do as a nation to show that we value each and every person and that we truly believe that in America, everyone should have a fair and just opportunity for health.
Should there be one standardized set of metrics that every community adheres to as it reopens, or should those metrics be flexible based on demographic factors?
Well, I think that there should be a core set that everyone is using, and then areas can do more than that. I'm on the commission to restart and recover New Jersey, and part of a 7-state coordinating body. And we were just having a conversation around that. What are the metrics that should be collected? And clearly breaking down data by location, not just state and county, but down to the zip code. breaking down data by income, by race, by gender. If you're doing that, you're going to be able to see things that you otherwise wouldn't. And right now, those data aren't available to even be able to say specifically how different communities are doing.
I'd like to ask you to comment specifically on healthcare workers. When you you appeared last week on a CNN COVID-19 town hall, and the hosts played a clip of President Trump in which he said this. He said, "They're running into death just like soldiers run into bullets. I see that with the doctors and the nurses and so many of the people that go into these hospitals. It's incredible to see. It's a beautiful thing to see." What's your reaction to that analogy that he made?
Yeah, you know, when I heard that, and I heard that for the first time when I was on the air on that show, it doesn't strike me as a beautiful thing. You know, what would be a beautiful thing would be to ensure that every worker in America has what they need to be protected. Whether you're a healthcare worker, someone providing the care that's so needed in healthcare facilities, or you're a poultry worker, or meat processor, or someone putting food on shelves so that people can go to the store, or you're driving a bus, or whatever it is you're doing, it would be a beautiful thing if every single person had the protective gear that they needed, so that their risk wasn't any higher than it had to be. And what I said was, what those workers are doing is heroic. True, and they are heroes just as all of the other essential workers are heroes. But it's not beautiful that in America we're letting people put themselves in a risky situation where they shouldn't have to have the same level of risk that they currently do.
So I want to shift gears just a bit. 6 of the 14 states that have not expanded Medicaid as is allowed for under the Affordable Care Act. 6 of those 14 states are in the Appalachian region. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to what expansion has meant to states that have elected to expand, and your view on how that'll factor in as we work through this long process of recovery from the virus?
Without health insurance, people don't have the same choice as to what to do when they're sick. When I look at the guidance from CDC on what people are supposed to do when they're sick, the one of the first things on there is don't go to the healthcare facility. Call your doctor. Well, what do you do if you don't have a doctor? What do you do if you don't have health insurance and you're worried that going in for care will land you with a big bill? What do you do if you are an immigrant and looking to become a citizen and you worry that going in and getting government assisted care will impact on your immigration status because of what's called the public charge rules? What do you do if you're a farm worker and you're concerned that going in for healthcare will connect you to immigration and you'll be deported? Expansion of Medicaid is critically important because it ensures that those with the least income have access to high quality healthcare. And, you know, that's just a start. You know, even with that expansion, there would be people without health care. And we need to do more than that. We need to ensure that in the future, everyone in America has health insurance that provides high quality health care. Because, you know, I say 28 million without health insurance. It's a much higher number if you look at those who are underinsured, who don't have the full services that they really should need. And that includes things like mental health services. We were talking about stress. This is one of the most stressful periods in our history. And with that comes need for mental health and behavioral health services that many people just don't have the resources to be able to access.
Do you have any hope that the virus may influence some state legislatures to reconsider that decision not to expand Medicaid?
Well, you know, I hope so. You know, I led emergency preparedness and response at CDC for 4 years. And one of the things that we always strove to do was to keep response nonpartisan, to try and come together as a nation for what we all needed to do to look out for each other. And If we're doing that in this circumstance, then yes, you would see states stepping forward and say, you know what, people are hurting, they're suffering, let's do what we can to expand all of the potential government services. And so that includes Medicaid and food programs like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and WIC, which provides services for women and infants and children. We'd be coming together and saying, this is a singular time in our history, and we need to provide people with as much as we can. Even if we don't agree on how long we should provide that for, you know, come together and do it now when people are really hurting. So I hope so. You know, pandemics across history have had profound impact, and at times they've reordered priorities. And we'll have to see whether coming out of this, we truly get to a nation that is more just and fair and provides hardworking people with what they need to get going again. I think we have that potential, and so I'm optimistic about that.
To pull another quote from your op-ed, this is something that really stuck with me. Quote, whether because of lack of access to health care, low household income, immigration status, racial discrimination, disability, lack of safe or affordable housing, or myriad other factors, millions of people are going to pay for our nation's entrenched inequities that have existed for generations, but have become even more apparent and appalling during this pandemic, end quote. What do we need to do as a nation to bridge these disparities in vulnerability that are based on where you live, how much money you make, the color of your skin?
These are profound societal questions. As we look across rural America and we look at areas that where there's been major disinvestment, what can we do to spur investment in communities so that we're supporting people in rural America, hardworking people, people who want a good paying job that will allow them to take care of their family and save some money for the future. How do we spur that investment? There's a lot of money that's going to be coming forward to try and spur our economy during recovery. We need to apply that kind of equity lens and ensure that those dollars are going to some of the hardest hit communities that were in danger before this pandemic, and communities that are truly at risk of going away because of this pandemic.
Is it a different set of issues if we're talking about bridging disparities in healthcare between rural and urban communities, as opposed to bridging those disparities among races and ethnicities? Or are these fundamentally the same issues?
Well, there are different drivers for different issues. That rural America is extremely diverse. There is a ton of data that shows that that when you add issues of racial disparity, income disparity, geographic disparity together, it's more than additive. So whether you're looking at the prospects for Black Americans, Latino Americans, Indigenous people, they are worse at every income level. So there are fundamentally things that have to be addressed from the perspective of structural racism that's entrenched in our society in our history. Beyond that, though, that there are issues that are affecting people of every race in every community, and rural America and the needs of rural America are critically important regardless of race.
So, what would you like to add?
One of the things that concerns me right now is that the response to this pandemic is being hyper politicized. And that worries me greatly, because moving forward, we can't see science and public health science as the enemy of economic recovery. We can't see the interests of rural states and the interests of more urban states as being in opposition. We need to see the solutions to this as fundamental societal issues that we all have to tackle and find a way to come together around these issues. And what's given me hope is that there's been a lot of legislation that's been passed in Washington with near unanimous support. And that's a good thing. And I hope we can get back towards that, so that as we're looking at how do we spur the economic development that's necessary, how do we ensure that all workers are protected, that we come together around this and these issues aren't used to divide us further.